This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, the man who talks to the animals talks to you. And the women in black, who usually refuse to say anything, also talk. And we hear the story of a train leading to a horse racing track that few people know existed in Port Townsend over 100 years ago. And now, we go inside the Compass. During a 45-year career in Hollywood, Gary Giroux has trained more than 101 Dalmatians, all the owls who delivered mail in the Harry Potter movies, and everything else from dogs to penguins to an octopus. And he even learned how to train flies. That has to make Gary Giroux one of Hollywood's greatest animal trainers. Billed as the man who talks to animals, Giroux left Southern California years ago for what he hopes will be a quiet retirement in the San Juan Islands. But the business he created, Birds and Animals Unlimited, is still going strong. We talked with Giroux about some of his memories after nearly half a century of turning animals into Hollywood stars. Here are highlights from that conversation.
I wanted to mention for our listeners just some of the films, the ones that stood out to me because they are among my favorite. You were involved in, it looks like, most, if not all, of the Harry Potter movies. 101 Dalmatians, 102 Dalmatians, Dr. Doolittle, of course, The Jungle Book, of course, Mrs. Doubtfire, I'm trying to remember the animals there, Batman, Batman Returns, Lethal Weapon 3, Back to the Future Part 2, The Aviator, great film, The Last Starfighter, one of my favorites. I'm curious, of all that you've done and all the animals and all of the stunts, I guess if that's the correct word for what you do with animals, what's your favorite stunt by one of your trainees?
Oh, there's so many. There's so many. There's 45 years of them. The favorite project has lots of elements. Lots of favorite elements. Lots have to do, of course, with the individual animals we're working with, but it's all involved with the relationships with the trainers, the relationships with the film company, and obviously the what's written for the animals to do, and how much time we're given to prepare. So a favorite project has all of those elements involved. Never Cry Wolf was one of my favorites. The animals, the trainers, the producer, and the project itself was a fabulous project and a great experience and a great place. We were in Alaska for a long time.
There's, how about individual, I don't know if stunt is the right word, but when you have an animal do something, a particular behavior, what is that called? Is that a stunt? It is a stunt?
It's a behavior.
A behavior.
some of the fun ones. I'll stick with Never Cry Wolf. There's a sequence where the wolf was marking his territory.
Mm-hmm.
But a wolf doesn't lift his leg to mark like a dog does necessarily, so there's a whole long process of teaching this wolf to actually lift his leg. That was fun and rewarding. And he looked at us like we were crazy. They go on and on. The 101 Dalmatians was incredibly rewarding. Puppies, all species of puppies, or breeds of puppies are different, but the Dalmatians are just little sponges. They have good capacity. They have nothing cluttering up their minds, and so we were able to teach them some incredibly sophisticated things in a huge hurry. Along with the company Disney, that's been such a wonderful partner with us, a client of ours for so many years, gave us the opportunity to really stretch out with our adult dogs and the puppies on that. It was shot in England. We love England, so the whole package of that film, the staff, the animals, the company, was right and very rewarding.
Now, 101 Dalmatians was an older film, but 102, the sequel, a thought occurred to me as I was watching it, because they can do it now. Maybe a lot of these dogs running around are computer-generated. Were those all real dogs?
Actually, there was some computer work done in terms of multiplying the numbers of animals.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of the work done with the puppies was actually done. Mm-hmm. And trained. Computer animation is a complicated issue. It's evolved over the last 15 or 20 years into something that has the potential to actually recreate a animal and the behavior. They're not 100% there yet, but they're getting very, very close. The limiting issue is the expense. So a film company will, a wise film company, and one the animal physically cannot do, or process of filming the animal's behavior complicates their sequence, then they'll take what remains of a sequence and animate the parts that absolutely can't be done live, basically because of the expense, but secondarily because of the quality of the product. But it's getting there. They're getting more and more competent with that. And I think I'm kind of glad I'm old and retiring. I got my career. It'll be decades before there are large sequences produced with strictly animated animals.
An interesting question. Would people who do the kind of work you did sort of start becoming obsolete because of computers?
I don't think it in any time in the foreseeable future, mostly because the expense of animating, but also the technology of making fluid biological movement is so difficult because people's perception of an animated animal is just that. I mean, you can tell that it's not real. They get closer and closer, and some animals lend them their behavior and their movement lend themselves and their physiology lend themselves more to animation than others.
Mm-hmm.
But thank goodness it's going to be quite a while before everything is animated, because as soon as they can animate a whole animal sequence, they can animate people. They'll be able to animate people just at the same time. So I think it's a ways off.
Have you been involved in any incidents where an animal attacked or injured an actor or somebody on the set?
Knocking wood, there over the 45 years that I was in this business, there have been a few incidents, nothing serious, and I bless my lucky stars that I've gotten here without a serious accident.
In your 45 years of working with animals in the film business, you must have come across some actors who were scared of a particular, whether it's scared of a spider or scared of a tiger. Do you have any memories, stories to tell about actors who were particularly challenged in dealing with an animal?
Oh, God. I've worked with every kind of emotion. There are some that are 100% with the animal and the work that's being done. There are some that don't care. There are some that are afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Those people, you have to admire those people because that are concerned around the animals, because they have to be professional and go on, and then most of them can do. There's provisions made for an actor that's animal phobic, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That has a lot to do with the planning of how you approach a sequence.
I'm so trying to get names here, Gary. I want to hear Glenn Close was terrified of Dalmatians or whatever.
No, Glenn Close loved these creatures.
Mm-hmm.
She's fabulous. She's an incredibly talented person, obviously, but she's a wonderful human being. And basically, you find the vast majority of the film folks lean towards having an interest in the animals. Some of them a little too firm. Daniel Radcliffe. Mm-hmm. The Harry Potter series was incredibly fascinated. He loved the owls and was around the owls. And they would have to, occasionally, in the beginning when he was a youngster, they would have to come and drag him away from the owls to actually go do his work.
Now, I was reading an interview that you did with, I think, Scholastic, where they asked you about owls and owls being the wise old owl legend, and you working with owls on Harry Potter. It turns out owls aren't necessarily the smartest animal on the planet, are they?
It's a legend. There's not much truth to it. Each of the species of owls have a different capacity, of course. The barn owls are clever little things. Snowy owls, all they have to do in the wild is flop along and pick up a lemming. They don't have to use a whole lot of imagination, and it shows in their evolution. Snowy owls are probably one of the dimmest creatures that we worked with. Well, for example, when we're working with birds, we developed a system where we have a great big fan, and they fly in front of the fan in order to get close flying shots. A raven you can teach that behavior to in a couple of days. A hawk you can teach that to in a week, 10 days. Seagull a couple of days. It took 2 years to teach a snowy owl to fly in the wind machine.
Oh my gosh! I'm looking for the funniest story. I always like superlatives. The funniest, the fastest, the whatever. The funniest story from a movie set that you can think of involving you and the animals.
On Batman Returns, there is a sequence where Danny DeVito, dressed up in his massive foam penguin outfit, walked up to the bottom of a long staircase, and the monkey came down the staircase holding a letter and gave the letter to Danny.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that sequence was set up, he obviously was trained to bring the letter down the stairs to a double while we were rehearsing, and the double took the letter and gave the monkey a bait, or the trainer came and gave the monkey his treat.
Mm-hmm.
When Danny did it in the rehearsal, that's the way it was. But when they shot, the monkey came down the stairs, handed Danny the letter, and Danny went on with the scene and didn't give the monkey his treat, because you can't when they're shooting. And then afterwards, then the monkey gets reinforced, gets his treat.
Mm-hmm.
So about take three, the monkey, who monkeys being as clever as they are, came down the stairs with the letter, gave it to Danny, looked at Danny, knowing there was no treat coming, and just jumped on him. It jumped on him right and reached around his as much as he could around his big fat suit, right in his lower abdomen area.
I get you.
So I was very near and made a horrible monkey noise at times. So I went and picked the monkey off, and Danny was standing there, and he just stood there, and he looked down, and he said, "Somebody call the man who made this suit and give him a huge reward for this." Anyway.
So he was protected from injury.
Yeah.
Although he retired from Hollywood to a residence in the San Juan Islands, animal trainer Gary Giroux is still active, providing sanctuary and care for animals and occasionally helping with animal scenes in movies, television, and commercials. His business is called Gary Giroux's Birds and Animals Unlimited, and his website can be found at www.birdsandanimals.com. David Cunningham, KPTZ News.
We're going to interview the women in black. Looks like there's four of them. They're out here every Monday. They're holding a peace sign. And they're going to hand me a little brochure there, or a piece of paper, Women in Black, Port Townsend.
That was live audio as I approached the iconic peace activists who stand in silent protest every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. on Water Street, near the Nifty Fifties restaurant in Port Townsend. I knew little about these so-called women in black, other than the fact that they always remain mute. Passersby have called them vile names, accused them of disrespecting our soldiers who risk their lives for freedom, and have tried to engage them in debates. The women in black always respond with silence. So I wondered, can I make any of the women in black actually speak? And if I did, what would they say? Here's how that encounter unfolded.
I know you're supposed to be silent. I was going to see if I could get somebody to tell me a little bit about what you are, what you do.
Here the longest.
Susie's been here the longest.
No.
Which is Susie?
Well, she doesn't want to.
She doesn't want to? I know what you do is stand here silently every Monday. People walk by, you try to hand them these things, they probably ignore you a lot, or maybe they take them.
It's Port Townsend, they don't ignore us.
Of course not.
She spoke, but one of the other women in black walked away from me, shaking her head. She would not say a word.
But I do have a couple of questions. Would it be okay if I got your names? Would you be comfortable with that?
Sure.
What?
Susie Barta.
I'm Linda Abbott Rowe.
Vicki Mansfield.
Jan Bailey.
They identified themselves. Even the woman who initially refused to speak gave us her name, Susie Barta. And then, as if a dam had burst, they started opening up to me.
How long have you been coming out here?
I've been coming for 8 years, regularly.
8 years? Mm-hmm. Every Monday, pretty much, when you
can? Yes.
In the snow?
Yes. Blizzards, all of it. Yeah.
And over the years, have there been any incidents, either positive, funny, good?
All of the above.
All. How long have you been coming out here?
6 years.
Six years or so,
something like that.
Is it the same 4, 5, 6?
It's pretty much. We had up to 35.
35.
It was wonderful.
When was that?
Oh, it was at Memorial Day, wasn't it? When we called around and got friends.
Is it always women, or are there men in black as well?
There's two men that
often. Several, actually. They don't come regularly. Two of them come often.
Yes.
I was going to ask what the women in black think of Men in Black, but I was referring to the movie.
And for the next several minutes, the usually silent women in black became positively chatty. Here's how it went.
But you actually do have men in black.
We do. Yes.
We don't get that as a joke because we take you quite seriously.
And although I'm always looking for a lighthearted approach to things, this is a very serious business, what you're out here for. Is there any one of you that would like to talk specifically about why it's important to you personally to be out here?
Because it's my way of being able to stir people to think about peace. We don't, as a rule, speak. We try to be silent because there's a tremendous power in silence. And I have been in another group. I was in another group for 7 years and then came here, moved here. So I'm new to this group. But there have been occasions when we were violently opposed in the other group and threatened with violence. And our answer was silence. And it was very effective. They finally just went away because it is very hard for violence to oppose steadfast silence. And to be steadfast is what the women in black all over the world are and do. We just stand here. Basically, of course, it started in Argentina with the grandmothers who stood around the square silent, and they weren't always silent. They sang and so forth and screamed sometimes. But mostly they just stood there and demanded their children and grandchildren back. It gradually spread as a silent vigil until it's all over the world. And there are different specific issues here and there. The needs of each society, but the basic need always is to find answers other than violence. In Jerusalem, the Arab and Jewish women stood together with bombs and bullets, and instead they held hands. It's not a bad idea.
I think it's important, too, to recognize the victims of violence and war, and that's one reason we stand in silence at protests, so that they are noted and recognized and honored. I've been told, too, that women in Poland during the Second World War dressed in black and stood in silence for those victims. So there's a lot of different origins that I think come together today.
Do you ever feel like you're making a difference, or do you ever feel a sense of futility?
It can feel futile. yes, but once a week everybody that walks by has to remember there's a war on, and too many times they don't. I think for me particularly, it's sometimes a challenge just to keep my mouth shut for the full hour and not argue back when somebody comes by and makes a rude comment, you know.
I've heard honks. I've seen peace signs.
Yes, we
did. What other things do you experience while you stand here?
Yeah.
And it has happened that we've gotten hugs from people.
Oh, yes.
We do get a lot of things.
Yes. And flowers?
Yes.
Yes. Someone bring you hot coffee on a cold day.
It has been offered to us.
Yes. The nifty 50s here.
Even some chocolate. I mean, and I think people do notice.
Yes.
People do notice.
Yeah.
What issue would they take with
this? They think we don't support the troops.
Huh.
That's the problem. That is the worst thing, is that they don't realize that we support them so much we want them home. I think that's the misunderstanding about the Women in Black movement.
Do any of you, or have any of you, had family members in the military?
Everybody. Even my sister served in Vietnam.
Did she then?
Yes, yes. And her son is a Special Forces Army, and
how does she feel about Women in Black and what you do?
I think she has trouble with it because she, again, sees it as not supporting her son, the soldier, and mm-hmm. you know, or our dad, who was in World War II, and, you know, all the way along.
So you do have a military history in your family.
Yeah, yeah, I do. But this is what I can do.
In the early years of standing, we were at the fountain downtown here. And there were some angry people. People were much more engaged at that point in for and against the war. Very, very concerned. And there was one man who came and was very upset and spoke really angrily to us. But what right did we have? He was a veteran from Vietnam. And how could we be doing this? And he went on. We stood silently. And he went on and on and on in his anger. And suddenly he ran out of energy, stood quietly for a moment and said, looked at us and said, you know, maybe you're right. We talked about it afterwards, and our sense was the silence, the fact that we did not engage and respond to anything. We just listened. Mm-hmm. And it was hugely moving for all of us.
One of the points of standing here is that it is impossible for people to ignore us. As we stand here, we watch passersby, and they must respond in some way, even if it is to look away and pretend to be interested in something else, which is a natural response when you don't want to be engaged. But still, it's a response. It has moved something in them for that instant. And it's these tiny rolling pebbles. This wears things away a little and a little. We don't do much, but we move people.
I think the silence is important.
Have you ever had any incidents where someone saw you outside of the realm of the women in black and said anything to you about it?
Yes. Yes, I did. I was in a pub down the road, just a wee bit here, when the waitress came over and said to me, you're one of those black women. And it's the first time anybody's ever said anything like that.
With the Women in Black in Port Townsend, this is David Cunningham for KPTZ News.
In March of 1889, the Port Townsend Morning Leader reported that Captain H.L. Tibbles had sold his entire lake property just outside of Port Townsend to a syndicate of Eastern gentlemen. The area included Tibbles Lake, which was to be stocked with swans, and pleasure boats were to be added in time. A grand three-story hotel was to be built, and a horse racing track would encircle the lake. In less than 2 years, townspeople would be traveling by electric train to watch the horse races from the new bleachers built for that purpose. The train, powered by a plant built at the lake, left Water and Quincy Streets, proceeded up Jefferson Street to F, eventually skirting the fairgrounds at North Beach, turning left on Cook Avenue, and proceeding up the long incline to Tibbles Lake. Once there, they reveled in the horse races. The rest of the dream never materialized. The Port Townsend Belt Railway was 5.5 miles long and was one of three railroad companies operating in a town of just over 5,000 people, but was the only railway extending to the wilderness surrounding the town. Although there is some development in the area now, it's still difficult to imagine train tracks and streetcars in this setting. The Jefferson County Historical Society has kept alive many stories from the past. Am I the only person in the county that didn't know about the train to Tibbles? I decided to ask Greg West, the first person I saw walking down Cook Street on what was previously the old rail bed. Did you know about the train that went to Tibbles Lake up that incline?
No, I'd never heard about that until you mentioned it. look at it now and you look at those tree-lined streets and think about a urban streetcar clattering up that hill 120 years ago.
That's just amazing. I mean, it's a steep hill.
A grand hotel, a racetrack, pleasure boats to row among the swans on a warm summer evening, and a streetcar to get you there for a dime. Within 2 years, the Depression of 1893 put an end to these dreams, and all three rail companies disappeared from the map. But maybe if you listen closely. On Cook Avenue in Port Townsend, I'm Tim Quackenbush for KPTZ News.
This week's Compass contains material that previously aired on KPTZ and was written and produced by David Cunningham, Steve Evans, and Tim Quackenbush. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. with the repeat Saturday at noon, exclusively here on KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. And remember, if you have a news tip of any kind, send an email to news@kptz.org. If your tip checks out and is used on KPTZ, you'll be credited on the air. That email again for news tips is news@kptz.org. For the news team here at KPTZ, 91.9 FM, Port Townsend, I'm David Cunningham.
Mm-hmm.